This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. elmad.pardes.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to This Pardes Life. I'm very, very excited to have friend, Pardes faculty, and lots of other things, Rabbi Amy Auerberg, in our studio together with us today. Rabbi Amy Auerberg is the first woman ordained as a conservative rabbi by the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. She serves as the director of the Pardes Rodef Shalom, Pursuer of Peace Communities Programs, helping synagogues and Jewish organizations place the pursuit of peace in interpersonal relationships at the center of their communal mission. Rabbi Auerberg also serves as a spiritual director and interfaith dialogue activist in the San Francisco Bay Area. Her book, From Enemy to Friend, Jewish Wisdom in the Pursuit of Peace, was published by Orbis Books in 2014. Those are just the thumbnail basic headlines, but we're going to get to know Rabbi Auerberg much, much better today. Thank you very, very much again for coming in to speak to us today. And I'm especially fascinated by what you spend the bulk of your professional and a lot of your personal time on, which is the whole issue of peace work. You were the first woman rabbi. You've done lots and lots of other things. How did you become involved in peace work, and how did it become so important to you?
So first of all, thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm actually personally a big fan of the This American Life show. It's a really very fine, astute, and creative kind of medium, really, that they've created. So this is fun. This Pardes Life, I love it. I'm very glad to be here. So like any shift in the course of our lives, there's rarely a single moment when the heavens opened up and everything changed. So there probably were a number of points of conception for this new area of my work. But it is remarkably easy for me to identify the moment when it shifted. As you may have said, I was ordained in 1985, so it's 31 and some years that I've been a rabbi. I've done a lot of other things and was deeply engaged in some other work when unexpectedly I had an experience which most honestly I can only describe as a call from God. I do tell the story in my book because it was so so central to me. I happened to be in Israel. My husband and I were in Israel in the late December 2004. My older stepson was on a gap year on Nativ, and we came to visit, and there were sometimes we were with him, and there were times when he was busy with his own stuff or with his friends or with his studies, and we had a list of people we wanted to see and things we wanted to do, and some of those were reconnecting with people that were old friends and colleagues, and in other cases there was, of course, there's always a list of places that I've always wanted to visit. So high on my list at that point, and the one that we got to on that particular trip was Neve Shalom Wat Al Salam, Oasis of Peace, which is now fairly well known. I'd say it's a collaborative town located near Latrun, between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, that was intentionally created, as I understand it, by a Catholic priest, Father Bruno Husar, who was born Jewish. There's a whole other story there, which would be interesting to explore. In any case, he created this town as a place where Jews and Arabs, and that is the language that the people of that community use, would live together. Not a spiritual community, not, you know, Walden Pond, just a village, a town, but that people would come to it knowing that the town was an exercise in coexistence. And over the years, they're developed, so the life of the town has developed. It's had its ups and downs over the years, but the town has flourished. At a certain point, they're developed within the town, which has its own school for the kids who live there and so on. They developed an institution called the Beit Sefer LeShalom, the School for Peace. which is now, I would say, an international center, a think tank, and a center of practice for issues related to dialogue. And the School for Peace works with journalists from all over the world and social justice activists from all over the world, and they bring together Jewish Shoah survivors with descendants of German Nazi perpetrators and so on. They do all kinds of remarkable dialogue work. Their signature program is a three-day program in which they bring each time about 100 16-year-olds, half of them from Jewish schools. I think it's mostly Jewish secular schools in Israel, and Arab-Jewish or Palestinian-Israeli kids from within the Green Line. Obviously, those school systems are separate, so having these kids come together for 3 days of dialogue is remarkable on the most basic of levels. These aren't kids who are, you know, normally playing sports and theater and so on together. So I knew about this program, and we just happened to be, if you believe in happenstance, we just happened to arrive on the first day of that program and got to watch behind a one-way mirror as one group, one subgroup of the group of 100 were doing what under any other circumstances would have been ordinary icebreaker activities, the kind that you would see at the beginning of any youth group, kinus, conclave, whatever. And of course, the kids all look alike. The Israeli Jewish kids and the Palestinian kids are all olive-skinned, and you often can't tell who's who. They were playing those same kinds of games about learning each other's names and so on, except that there was absolutely nothing ordinary about these kids being in the same room all together. The program was voluntary. Everybody knew exactly what they were getting into. And the time passed for me very, very quickly, and way too soon, the person who had driven us kind of tapped us on the shoulder and said, you know, we need to go now. I want you to meet the director, and then it'll be time to go back to Jerusalem. I was nowhere near ready to go. I had this strange physical sensation of being riveted to the floor. And then kind of walked through. Of course, I wanted to meet the director, and I politely got in the car and so on. And then when we got back to Jerusalem, I told my husband what had happened, and I realized this is hard to do on radio or podcast. It requires as a visual image here, which I'll try to describe. I realized that when I tried to tell the story of what had happened for me there, I could only tell the story if I made a motion, which I can only describe as rolling up one's sleeves. And then I told my stepson what had happened, and I told a couple of friends what had happened. And I realized that every time I told the story, I used more or less the same words. And that same gesture of rolling up my sleeves was clearly part of the story. In fact, although I'm not a person who believes in a God who physically comes down and gives people assignments or literally rolls up people's sleeves to tell them what to do, I can only say that I felt that I had some kind of experience of personal revelation, the content of which was roll up your sleeves, which meant to me that it was time for me to step back from some of the other work that I was doing and to find some way to serve the cause of peace. And that set in motion years of search, some professional work, some volunteer work, some a lot of personal work and study, ton of networking, a lot of travel, to try to find answers to the question, how was I supposed to be faithful to that moment of revelation that had happened to me? I could tell you some of the answers that came to me about that, but that was the moment, and it was life changing. So I stumbled down off the mountaintop, as it were, you know, having been ki'ilu, you know, as it were, at a place of revelation, and went back home, which was suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. I had never imagined that I would find myself in Minnesota, but these unlikely twists and turns in life, and I found myself in this new home in suburban St. Paul, and kind of looked up in the sky and said, as if God lives in the sky, and said, okay, I say yes, but I'm waiting for further instructions. Now, what should I do? I want to try to help. What should I do? Especially since the call had come in the context of Israeli-Palestinian grassroots peacemaking, what can I do given that I'm a rabbi in suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. What could I possibly do that could be of any help to the Middle East? So I stumbled around. I didn't really stumble around. In a way, I spent about 10 years looking for an answer. And on some level, I hoped that the answer would come with the same clarity that the original assignment had come with. And it never happened quite in that way. It was like, okay, I gave you the assignment. Now you have to figure out how to fulfill it. So what became very clear was that there were limits, of course, to how I could help in the Middle East. But what was clear is that as a rabbi in an American community, I could really make a difference by getting involved in interfaith dialogue work. In fact, when I had just come back from that trip to Israel, I kind of knocked on the doors of a number of Muslims and a number of Christians and was desperately trying to put together, especially a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group, right where I lived in Minnesota, and I wasn't getting anywhere, wasn't making any progress. But when I began to knock on doors and say, what's going on in bringing Jews and Christians and Muslims together, not about Israel and the Palestinian territories, but to learn about one another, to create relationship, to learn about one another's religions, and to create relationship across lines of religion and lines of prejudice and lines of stereotyping and misunderstanding and even hate. So, and then remarkably, someone actually stepped forward and said that they would pay me to do that work. Most interfaith dialogue activists that I know do their work for nothing. So that was, maybe that was a sign from God that someone was actually offering me a job in this. So I spent a bunch of years together with a really wonderful group of interfaith dialogue activists, Jews and Christians and Muslims in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Spent a lot of time building programs that would bring especially Jews and Christians and Muslims together. In retrospect, it became clear that after I had been working with these people for a number of years on all kinds of issues and having all kinds of educational programs that had no political content whatsoever, then when war would break out here in Israel or something terrible would happen, then in the context of already established strong trusting collegial relations with these other people, then of course we wanted to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, both to vent our pain and to ask the other side in anguish, you know, in these moments, why is your side doing what your side is doing, in both directions, really. So that was the interfaith dialogue piece. I also during this period got deeply involved in, God help us, an emerging field of intra-Jewish dialogue in the Jewish community in the United States. We need it in Israel, obviously, too. But more and more Jewish leaders were becoming aware that the state of discourse in the American Jewish community was really deteriorating, particularly, not only, but particularly around issues of Israel. And a number of us who had training and dialogue facilitation and so on began to talk about this and strategize and think about how could we create programs that would make a difference. So I became a participant in that. And again, since the original call had come in the context of Israel and Palestine, I realized that I was a fool if I thought I had any chance to make any contribution to this issue without knowing Palestinians, like most Jews of my generation anyway. I didn't know any Palestinians. I hadn't read any Palestinian literature. I'd grown up with a narrative according to which Palestinians were the other. And I didn't know anything about how the conflict looked from their side, how the history looked from their side. So I knew that if I was to be able to be of service in any way, not that I necessarily needed to change my opinions, but I certainly needed to know how people on the other side, as it were, think and dream and experience the conflict. So I made a bunch of trips to Israel, and what was new for me during this period to the West Bank, which I'm now comfortable calling Palestine, because that's what many of the people who live there, that's how many of the people who live there understand that place. I know that's a controversial thing to say, but just saying that that's the truth for me. So I made a whole bunch of trips to find Palestinians who would talk to a rabbi. And I discovered to my surprise that there were many who did, and went on a variety of, mostly what I did was to seek out, I sought out peace activists in Israel as well, but that wasn't hard. That was just a delight. Came as a great surprise to me that there, you know, just from reading the American newspapers, you would never know that there are scores, if not, maybe not hundreds, but certainly more than 100 collaborative Israeli-Palestinian grassroots relationship building projects. So I wanted to meet the Israelis, of course, who were on the Israeli side of that, and that wasn't hard. What was hard was meeting the Palestinians on their side, because that felt like enemy territory to me. And it was really challenging to listen to the critical things that they had to say about Israel. Sometimes I wanted to get up from the table and run, because sometimes I wanted to scream, which I knew it wouldn't be useful to my project of serving the cause of peace if I, you know, blew up and screamed that they were talking nonsense. But that was what my instinct wanted. So I had many, many experiences where I wanted to burst out laughing, or what they were saying was absurd or terrible. But I realized that was a learning process that was essential for me to engage in. So that was part of the work as well. And so after a few years had passed, man, maybe eight years had passed since that day at Neve Shalom Wat Al Salam, I realized that I had accumulated a body of stories that I thought were some pretty interesting encounters in the interfaith realm and in the intra-Jewish realm and in the grassroots. I don't know any diplomats. This wasn't about my interviewing politicians, but my talking with grassroots activists. So I realized that I had a pretty interesting body of stories about that work that I'd been doing for nearly 10 years. And of course, during this period, what I didn't say but is obvious, is that I was studying like mad and combing sacred Jewish texts to learn as much as I could about what the Jewish sources said about the nature of peace and the nature of conflict and the possibilities for transforming conflict of all kinds, both interpersonal and larger intergroup conflict, about which the sources do have things to say. So it became clear that the next thing for me to do was to write a book. So I did write the book, as you kindly said, was published in 2014, which was essentially a conversation between some of the Jewish texts. It's not a comprehensive account of the Jewish texts on the subject at all, but just a kind of a sprinkling of Jewish texts in conversation with the stories that I had to tell, in such a way that I hoped that the wisdom of the texts would illuminate some of what had unfolded in those human encounters, and also that the human encounters that I described would bring to life some of what the texts were talking about. And then what became clear, I didn't know this when I began writing a book, but what became clear toward the end of the writing process is that the thread that connected those stories and those texts for me was the question of individual spiritual practice. What does it mean to be a Rodef Shalom? What does it mean to be a pursuer of peace? Again, by which I mean not a diplomat, not a secretary of state, not a professor of political science, because when the psalmist says, Bakesh Shalom Verodfehu, seek peace and pursue it, in Psalm 34, I'm quite certain that whoever wrote the Psalms was not talking to political leaders in that pasuk, in that verse. That's a commandment for everyone. So what was really the central question that was emerging for me is, what has to happen in our own work on ourselves to make it more likely that when we find ourselves in a situation of conflict, of tension, of betrayal, of painful controversy, either if we're one of the parties to that argument, or if we're a third person who has the possibility to either pour kerosene on the two sides, on the conversation between the two sides, or has the possibility to enter and somehow bring a peaceful presence that can at least help restore a relationship, if not resolve. Often these conflicts can't be resolved, but sometimes relationships can be healed, even in the midst of often, not always, but often in the midst of the most painful ruptures in relationship, be they interpersonal or collective. So what was really important for me is, what's the soul work that makes the difference? For example, for me personally, what's the difference between the times that I'm in the middle of one of these conversations and I blow it? I just blow it. I just respond with instinctive anger, disrespect, lack of curiosity, and just sort of blurt out my stump speech because what the person on the other side has said was I considered so outrageous. What's the difference between that kind of moment when I blow it on the one hand and the kind of moment when I hear something that's really upsetting to me and I somehow, with God's help, remember to stop, to take a breath, to ask myself in a way, who is the person that I want to be in the world or in this moment? How I have choices about how to respond. How do I want to respond that's consistent with my values? So what is it? How is it that sometimes I blow it and sometimes I do well, even though, you know, I read all of this stuff, I have all this literature in my head. It's not that I don't know what's the right response to me, but how is it that sometimes I get it right and sometimes I blow it? I think that's the answer to that is the quality of the soul work, the extent to which I have cultivated qualities of soul, and I've come to think about this very much in the context of Musar work, Musar being a thousand-year-old tradition of Jewish spiritual development, which articulates midot, or soul traits, qualities of soul, which are articulated by the Musar masters as ways for us to become more righteous human beings, not as a conflict transformation system. But I realized the more I knew about conflict, the more I could appreciate how much the midot, the traits that the Musar masters were talking about, are precisely those qualities of soul that are essential in the midst of conflict. Things like kindness, and compassion, curiosity, truthfulness, self-awareness, courage, and the like. So that was the book. And then the story continues.
One of the things I have most trouble with is not hearing people whose ideas are very different from mine, but when people attack other people on a personal level, ad hominem attacks, I think is what it is. I'm interested in if you have any insight from your own life and your own dealing with it, or theoretically, of how you deal with the situation where either you're attacked or you're hearing somebody else being attacked personally, rather than the ideas that they're saying, and especially if you have anything to share from your own life or personal examples, I think that would be very helpful to me.
So it's such an important question, and as you were talking, I thought you were gonna say something about social media, because we know I'm convinced that living in relationship to social media, as we all do, has made all of this very much worse, has made the symptoms worse, and made the question more harif, more sharp. It's a difficult question. It helps me a little bit to draw on what I know of the theory of peace and conflict, which is to say, when I first got into this work, I thought that Jews get uniquely crazy on the subject of Israel, that when the subject of Israel comes up, what is touched in us is so deep that we are prone to losing everything we know about how to treat other human beings and other things. I actually had a colleague in the dialogue field who said, you know, the Israel conversation just makes people crazy, which was kind of funny, and a funny statement, and also kind of true. I learned along the way that, and this can be hard for some people to hear, there's actually nothing unique about the Israel conversation. The scholars of conflict know that this is how people behave when they find themselves in the midst of polarized conflict. I once wrote a little article called "This Is Your Brain on Conflict." What the human brain does—it's the limbic brain, especially the brain where part of the more ancient part of the brain where, which is the seat of emotion, particularly anger and self-protection—that our oh so sophisticated 21st century brains still respond to verbal or ideological or interpersonal attack in much the same way that the brain once responded to the sight of a bear running across the savannah about to, God forbid, eat our child. You know, we respond to, we have an instinctive response, which is fueled by hormones and so on, that you might say makes us crazy, makes us aggressive. So many people who know better, many people who know it is utterly unacceptable, thank you, unconscionable, according to Jewish ethics, to insult, to degrade another human being, to attack them in public and so on. Such a basic Jewish conflict, such concept, you know, it says in the Talmud that person who insults another in public, that's equivalent to murder. We could really talk at some time whether the person who wrote that, was that intended hyperbolically or was that intended really kind of seriously, that some people die for a moment. There's some kind of experience of death of self when you experience a huge kind of act of shaming. So it helps me a little when I'm able to say it. I'm not always. Sometimes when I read something in which one Jewish leader excoriates the other in the most disrespectful of ways, I respond with anger. What's the matter with so-and-so? Don't they know better? Yes, of course, they have their strong opinion. They may disagree with so-and-so, but you can't do that as a Jewish leader. It's not acceptable. Sometimes I try to remember that the person who reacts that way is suffering. That person has been so traumatized by the presence of that opinion that was stated on the other side. And sometimes it can be most inflaming, most enraging when it's one of our own. You know, if someone who I don't think I have anything in common with says something that I consider to be outrageous, it's like, okay, well, I wouldn't really expect anything more of them. But someone in my family or someone in my extended family, my community, says something that is anathema to me, it's really enraging. Like, how could there be someone who's like of my team who could possibly say such a thing? It sounds like anger, but there's a deep fear, there's a deep kind of suffering. Like it's unsettling to my sense of reality, to the way in which I understand values and the context in which I live, to encounter such a view. So that's maybe a long-winded way of saying when I see that kind of behavior, I try to remember that there is deep suffering underneath that bad behavior. And sometimes I just get angry like anyone else does. And I used to spend a lot of effort. Well, early, the story that I didn't tell is that early in my journey on this work, there was there were a couple of people, well, one person in particular in the shul that I belonged to, who used the then new congregational listserv as a vehicle for some really, in my view, really horrifically judgmental and aggressive language, particularly around Israel issues, just, you know, bull in a china shop, just insulting the whole, assuming that whoever, the half the congregation, a fourth of the congregation was reading these messages, just really spitting this very, very aggressive stuff onto the listserv. And I lost a lot of sleep and spent a lot of years sort of trying to figure out that phenomenon, trying to figure out what was the right response. And I now think that there isn't always a right response. Sometimes someone is in so much pain that is the best they can do. That is the only way that they can communicate. I also know that when you have some advance notice, the art of dialogue facilitation is to prevent that kind of situation from happening. Because once the person is so inflamed, it's very difficult. It takes really a masterful facilitator to come and approach that person and with love and respect and understanding, and to help them feel heard so that they can then lower the decibel level and speak in a way, really express themselves, but in a way that other people can hear. The art of dialogue facilitation is the art of setting up conversational environments that, to the extent possible, don't allow that kind of speech to erupt.
We've been speaking a lot about controversy, about machloket, although we haven't used that word, about disagreement. If I look at your own life, you've sometimes been the subject a lot of machloket, sometimes the subject a lot of disagreement, and I'm sure you've also participated in different ways in different issues or arguments that have come about. I'm interested if you can share with us some of the stories, and not necessarily in piecework, but where you felt yourself either the subject of controversy or a part of something, and how you've dealt with it in your past, and that how that informs you and makes you the person that you are today.
So I guess I want to go back to childhood for a moment. My father, Zichron Levracha, was a public servant for all of his life. He was an attorney, and then served for 12 years in the Pennsylvania State House, and then served for 12 years in the U.S. Congress. He and my mother both, who were gone, would be so beyond horrified at what passes for public discourse now in the United States in particular. So my father was of a pragmatic sort of nature. He wasn't a Bernie Sanders sort of figure. He was a, what shall I say, meat and potatoes Democrat. You know, he was devoted to creating more opportunity for people who had less. That was what his work was all about. One of the things he was most proud of in his career was that he had a role when he was in the Pennsylvania State House in making Temple University, which at the time, which is located in Philadelphia, is where we lived, which at the time was a private university. It's hard to remember that. And he had a role in the process by which Temple became a public university. And he had grown up poor personally, as had my mother. My mother was an immigrant. He took tremendous joy in having participated or exerted some leadership in a process by which opportunity would be extended to people to whom it had previously been denied. So in a way, he was a justice activist. So I think I'm very much his daughter in that way. Also, I am the younger sister of a very smart older brother. And everyone in the family says that when I was a little girl, or maybe not so little, I used to say, "That's no fair," a lot, which I think is often the anguished cry of the youngest child. So I think that's no fair was in my kishkas. So I certainly found myself in the midst of controversy in the struggle for women's ordination in the conservative movement. It didn't come to me. I pursued it. I placed myself there. I didn't have to. There are ways in which I'm personally conflict averse. I'm not the first person to jump into an interpersonal fight. I would rather things be peaceful. But on that sort of collective level, I felt that there was an injustice, and I wanted to participate with a lot of other people in trying to see it righted. And so I had lots of experiences during that period, which was in my late 20s, and then I was ordained. I was 30 when I was ordained, and then in my early 30s, which from my perspective now is looking back, I was young. Found myself in the midst of lots of controversy before the ordination decision was made, and there was very high-pitched machloket, public controversy within the conservative movement. Then once the decision was made and I was in rabbinical school, there were very interesting conversations among students who were in the rabbinical school at the time, many of whom had entered the seminary, who had entered a seminary that did not ordain women and suddenly found themselves in a very different place. And the conversations with the faculty were not always placid, as the case with any great change. In that case, I usually remembered that it wasn't personal. I mean, it was personal because I'm a woman. People often say, "Well, it's not personal. It's not about you." Well, yeah, it's just about women, and I'm a woman, so it is personal. But they weren't insulting or attacking or excoriating me as Amy Albert. That wasn't their intention. But it was helpful to me in that case that, since I ended up being the first, I became kind of a symbol. And actually, in many cases, rabbis in general are symbols, and the way in which people get angry at rabbis is also many people are angry at the Jewish tradition or the Jewish community as a whole. And when a person's a leader, they feel and absorb feelings that belong to other people. So, I had a lot of experience then with taking an adulation that didn't belong to me either, just for which I was a stand-in. You know, I was a symbol for equal rights for women, and also some nastiness, some nasty critique that also had to do with the issue. But for, you know, that I, at first, for the short period when I was the only one, that I was the only woman rabbi in the conservative movement, that I had to figure out how to do my own inner work in order to take that in and not take it in order to recognize where this really belonged and what ways it was about me and it wasn't about me. But when I got involved in the Israel conversation or the Israel-Palestine conversation, it was really conversationally much harder than anything I had ever done. The level of passion was higher, and so the level of bad conversational behavior, was worse than anything I had experienced before. I mean, that was really a high-pitched, polarized conversation is a euphemism. And that's because it feels like everyone feels like their life depends on it, which to some extent is true. Our lives do depend on it. Those of us who live in Israel or Palestinians, who also feel, in some cases, who feel that they're in mortal danger because of violence as well. But even when we're sitting in suburban St. Paul and really nobody's in mortal danger in that moment, the level of symbolic importance of those issues is so great that people do go on the attack. And it takes a lot of work. You know, I'm remembering the story when Yaakov is about to re-encounter his brother Esav, and Yaakov assumes that Esav is still in the place where he had been 20 years before, when the last thing Esav said when Yaakov left was, "I want to kill my brother." So when he comes back, he's, expecting to be attacked in that way. And just before the reunion, it says in the text that Yaakov was very much afraid and distressed. There's a superfluous words in the text in which the commentators, of course, rush in and say, well, why are there two verbs? Why couldn't it just say he was afraid? Why does it have to say he was afraid and he was distressed? And a couple of commentaries say he was afraid that he would be killed and he was distressed that he might kill. So kind of the answer to your question is that my practice in these controversies is both learning how to be safe in those circumstances, and also how not to do damage to other people when I get caught up in the flames of conflict.
That's really beautiful, Amy. Really inspirational, especially that last piece, the little Devar Torah. But you know, when I look at the world around me and I look how many hard and difficult things are happening, and I know that so many of us are discouraged, even angry and hostile to the entire subject that you're talking about, how do you relate to this phenomenon of people just giving up and feeling it's not worth the candle?
So when I started on this journey, I was very much focused on the large international issues. Well, one issue, the one that was closest to my heart. I desperately wanted to help bring peace to Israel, as if I could make a difference there. I completely empathize with people who have despaired, certainly of diplomatic processes, peacemaking processes, and I feel that myself, that the diplomatic horizon is fairly dim, and it seems lately, not just in Israel, but in America, that violence seems to be on the rise. Rather than subsiding, so I certainly haven't stopped praying for the larger cause of peace in the world. I pray every day and a lot for violence to end and for justice to come. My day-to-day work now is more is on the narrower level, is on a more micro level. And much of that relates to the work that that I'm doing with the really wonderful sponsorship and partnership through Pardes, through Rabbi Dr. Daniel Roth's incredible Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution, which does some really extraordinary work within Pardes and all over Israel, and the Pardes Rodef Shalom Schools Program, which works on teaching text and teaching skills to children at the middle school level and day schools in the United States. That's just an inspired idea. I have nothing to do with that program. So I have just an inspired idea to teach kids at that level. What does Judaism have to say, and how can you handle relationships more more gracefully? And so I now direct the Pardes Rodef Shalom Communities Program, whose mission is to work in particular with rabbis and generally with congregations and with communities, with Jewish communities in North America, to raise the presence of the mitzvah of Rodifat Shalom, of the pursuit of peace, to pride of place, to centrality in the complex of values that every community thinks is central. That I often say that when you walk into a synagogue, walk into any building, maybe you walk into a synagogue, and there are certain values that are so palpable in the culture of that synagogue that you can all, they're almost in the air. You can almost breathe them in as you walk in. For some, it's community. For some, it's justice. Or for some, it's hospitality. I want Rodifat Shalom, and I mean that now, not at all in a political sense, but the way many or most of the texts talk about pursuit of peace in interpersonal and communal contexts. I want for more and more and more Jews to think, to be pursuers of peace, that is to say, to be working on what are the best ways that we can do relationship in really in keeping, not just with Jewish sociology, how do Jews do relationship? They talk fast and they talk with their hands and they interrupt one another. No, what Jewish tradition has to teach us is just a wealth and wisdom, a tremendous reservoir of wisdom teachings and practices that teach us how to do the difficult stuff of relationship, interpersonally and communally. And that's what the program is all about. And so I no longer believe that I, as one person, can have any direct impact on the larger cause of peace in the world. But I can and do every day try to get individuals, individual Jews mostly, and individual communities to think seriously and boldly about how we can be peacemakers in the midst of our own lives and our own community lives.
Thank you, Amy, for sharing your Pardes life with us.
Thank you so much.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, ELMAD.pardes.org.